Good morning. It's time for the Estate and Medicaid Planning Hour with the Herzog Law Firm.
Will you still need me? Will you still feed me when I'm 64?
Ooh. And welcome and good morning. I'm Harry Miller.
Good morning. I'm Dave Kubikin.
And welcome to the Herzog Law Firm's Estate Medicaid Planning Hour, which is brought to you every Saturday morning from 8 to 9 o'clock. Dave and I are two of the attorneys with the firm, and we are here this morning to happily answer your calls, try to answer your questions, enlighten you about some of the issues you all ought to be thinking about in terms of estate planning, estate administration, asset protection planning, wills, trusts, all those different things that we tend to put off to another day. And if you would like to be our first caller here this Saturday morning, you can pick up the phone and dial David and I directly at 518-476-5900. That's 518-476-5900. Morning, Dave. How's everything? How's everything in your neck of the woods?
Everything's good, Harry. Good morning. I don't know if you were on to hear any of the weather up here, but it's not bad. It was actually incredibly warm. You probably had, 70 degrees mm-hmm. 75 degrees in North Carolina this past week?
Yeah, but in the 60s, low 60s. It was a little chilly, and they got in the low 60s.
Oh. How dare you? Well, we got to 54, 55, right?
Yeah, when I left the house yesterday at 3, it was 57. And by the time we hit 7 o'clock, I think we were below 30. So it got cold in a hurry.
Yeah, it was one of those days, Harry, where the high temperature for the day was at 12:01 a.m. because every hour of the day it got colder and colder and colder. It was pretty interesting. But we had snow, and now it's just ugly piles of icy snow because so much has been washed away from all the rain. Yeah. Although I feel like if you look at the 10-day forecast, which I like to do this time of year, 10 days from today on the forecast is March 1st. So we're getting there. We're almost there.
Oh, yeah. Usually, certainly by St. Patrick's Day, we usually have turned a corner and things are getting better. We're actually I hate to tell you, but the daffodils are starting to pop their little leaves out, and I saw the first hints of forsythia, those beautiful yellow forsythia bush flowers, just starting to pop their little heads down here.
We're all very happy for you, Harry.
You still need a light jacket in the morning when it goes out. It's a little chilly. You need a light jacket or something.
I think we may want to stop talking about the weather going forward while Harry's
okay,
down
enough,
in
enough about the weather. Enough about the weather.
Depressing. So, Harry, this past week we had our week of webinars, 2 p.m. every day we had a different webinar. And it was the kind of usual suspects of the webinars, and one of them, wills versus trusts, that webinar in particular, I actually wanted to talk to you about it because there were a couple things that came from that webinar that I think we should talk about. The first thing was the normal question about the difference between revocable and irrevocable trusts and, the Medicaid Asset Protection Trust we do, which is, it's technically irrevocable. But,
it's an irrevocable trust.
Most of the benefits of revocable and your control is still there, but it's irrevocable, and irrevocable means something in the rest of our discourse in life, right? If I gave you something irrevocably, you wouldn't think I'm going to get it back from you, but I can in the case of this Medicaid trust. And I came up with an analogy that I am not sure if it's any good, and I was going to let you and Ben and the rest of the audience figure it out. But someone was
you're just
at me
stepping
on the
into
webinar.
Some treacherous territory there, David.
Well, nothing happens in life without risks, and this is I'm taking a risk here.
All right.
So, I said to the gentleman, "Your toaster. You can move your toaster, right?" And he said, yeah. And I said, you can move your toaster by yourself. Yes. I said, your toaster is movable. I said, yes. So what about your fridge? Is your refrigerator movable? And his answer, which I was hoping would be his answer, was, it depends. I said, oh, what does it depend on? He said, well, it depends on if I have help. And I said, but you could pick whoever you want to help you move the fridge, right? And he said, yeah. So, well, Medicaid cares if you could move the fridge by yourself. They care about the toaster. They care about the microwave, perhaps. But they don't care about the fridge because you can't move the fridge by yourself. You need somebody else. Who do you need? Whoever you want. That's my analogy. What do you think?
Well, it's a pretty good one, I think, you know, because you know, the analogy is there. You have to, your irrevocable trust cannot be unilaterally revoked, right? Okay. That's what you're saying, I think. Whereas in a well, depends if the wheels are locked or not, I guess.
Okay, Ben, forget Harry.
Hold your fridge.
How was the analogy?
It was the best analogy I've ever heard in my entire life. I think you should go with it.
Oh, man, I can't tell how sarcastic you are and how serious you are.
There is absolutely no sarcasm coming out at all. I'm sorry, what's that dripping over my fingers?
First thing that popped in my head when you said it was your toast, but no. Sorry. No, you know what? Seriously. Enough frivolity on my part. But you know what? You're absolutely right. The revocable trust is absolutely within my control to do whatever I want with. Okay? And if nobody, not the trustee, not any beneficiary, nobody has to do anything but me. And I can keep it, you know, change it, make it go away, do whatever I want with it. The refrigerator, on the other hand, I know, believe me, I know it, whether it even has wheels or not, believe me, I cannot move my refrigerator by myself, that much I can tell you. And seriously, every irrevocable trust needs other people to intervene and do something in order to alter, amend, or revoke the trust. So I think it's a great analogy. And it's one
thank you, Harry.
That average people will understand. Absolutely.
Well, thank you. I'll Venmo you some money later on. Thanks for the tough words.
Looking at my account later today.
You know, in normal dialogue, right? If you get something irrevocably, if you read a letter that said, congratulations, you just won $10,000 irrevocably. I think you have $10,000 because in normal language, you have $10,000. And if I said to you, oh, don't do that, it's irrevocable. In normal life, you would think you can't undo it. But because we're not in normal life, we're in legal, definitions of things. Mm-hmm. It's really important to realize irrevocable means not revocable, and revocable is the word whose definition we care about so much. But revocable means Harry Miller can do something by himself. That's the key. It's not about whether something can be accomplished. The refrigerator can get moved. It's just you can't do it by yourself. And so if we have your children as your trustees and beneficiaries, and if you have the unilateral, the revocable ability to change your trust and remove your trustee and replace them with whoever you want or change your beneficiaries, then you're effectively controlling who's helping you move. And you control that. So
that's correct.
Of course, it came up in wills versus trust. The other thing that came up, which obviously we'd love to have callers at 476-5900. There's no more analogies to give, so please call. But one of the other slides on that wills versus trust is when do we, you know, we don't necessarily say you should, we recommend you do this or that, but when should you really consider a trust? And, you know, there's things like having property in multiple states, avoiding probates and ancillary probates, but one of them is where there are business interests that somebody has, whether it's a rental property, it might be a small business they own, it might be a big business that they own. And in that instance, having a trust becomes really, really important. we emailed about this a little bit, Harry. It's a couple parts business succession. It's a couple parts just making sure that the things you own, the assets you own, including business interests, rental properties, all go to the right people based on all the rules that you set forth. And thankfully, you're on the radio today, Harry, because of anyone I've ever met, you probably have the most clients with business interests. So I'm sure you could rattle off thousands of clients where you've had to do some more complicated planning.
Well, yeah. I mean, and I think the key to this is the last word that you said, planning. And it's unfortunately something that people, and I don't care if you have a small business or a great big business. You could just be a sole proprietorship, you know, running a, you know, plumbing and heating business, or you could have a big company that manufactures stuff or distributes things. Whether your company is small or big is really irrelevant. You have spent time, effort, and probably decades building your business, developing your client base, manufacturing, making your product, whether your product is legal services or it's a widget, making it better and better over time so that people want to buy your product as opposed to someone else's product. And yet, so many people that we see don't take the time and the effort. They don't think ahead. You know, you're 55 years old. Okay, probably in the next 10 years, you're going to be thinking about winding down, retiring, what's going to happen to your business. Okay, the key here is to getting a plan. And let me just tell all of you out there, if you haven't, David may be extolling my virtues of having lots of business clients, and that's probably just because I've been doing this about three times longer than he has. But he has business clients also, and he just wrote what I think is one of the most succinct articles that I think is in the Saratoga Business Review this month or something, but about
the
kinds of things that business owners need to focus on and often don't. And he, in about a thousand-word article, if that, hits on the major points that folks need to consider and consider before there's a business crisis. This is the same thing we run into people doing individual estate planning. They put it off, and all of a sudden, somebody has a health event, okay? The same thing happens in business. Mom or dad, whoever business it is, has been working, all of a sudden, boom, they have a stroke, they have a heart attack, they get a bad diagnosis, and they haven't done any planning. And now, as we keep telling you, you know, sooner is better than later. The worst time to do estate planning is in the midst of some type of crisis, whether it's a health crisis. In business, it could be a financial crisis. It could be something that happened with your business that's causing it to decline or whatever. Maybe you lost a key employee or something like that. You know, there are any number of things, as those of you in business are aware of, that could go on and on. So I guess I'll stop talking about a plan, but you have to have a plan. And it's not like when you're trying to develop a business succession plan, it takes time. This isn't something where you just walk into the lawyer's office and an hour later after a conference, you have a plan in place. This requires a series of meetings and discussions because we need to bring to your attention the important things you need to think about in making your plan, because your business is different than my business and it's different than somebody else's business. And so we have to look at what's going to happen, you know. I mean, I think the first thing people need to consider is if you either retired, died, just decided you were to move to California and rent a house on a beach, what's going to happen to your business? Are you going to sell it to an outside party? Do you have family members who are working in the business and who you might want to pass it on to, either by way of a gift or by way of a sale? That's a fundamental issue, don't you think, David?
Absolutely. The article itself was really about the succession plan, and there's another component of how this all fits into your estate plan. But just from like the succession point of view, as you're mentioning, your business has value, right? That's why you're working on it, and presumably that value continues to go up. You're so worried about your business and it's making money for you and your family that you're probably not planning for the end of your business or a big transition like someone retiring. or someone dying.
Correct.
When it comes to family businesses, family businesses mean that there's a business that's been in the family for a number of years. It doesn't mean that everybody in the family is in the business. And not everyone in a family business, whether they're all involved or not, are likely capable of continuing the business. And so my article says, all right, you know, you see it on TV kind of fact pattern. And you know, the article is written because of the show Succession on HBO that I've seen. Very good, actually. A lot of drama, as you would imagine. But, okay, we have one person who's the real go-getter in the family and you know, is their entire identity is working for the family business. We have someone else who has no interest in the family business, and, you know, they're out of town. And then we have another child who's involved in the family business, but, you know, if I was going to compare them to a movie character, they would be Fredo. Okay, from The Godfather. So maybe not going to be taking over. They're not Michael. They're Fredo. Okay? So my estate plan may be to treat all my kids the same, Harry, but when it comes to the business, which might be the largest asset, I don't want every single asset to necessarily be split evenly, but I want the value that I have to be split evenly. And that just doesn't happen. Mm-hmm. You need really complicated documents to make sure that is happening. Sometimes, I know you've done, I've read the language you've done before, where you'll put a provision in estate planning documents that equalizes and takes into account the value of things that pass outside of the trust, perhaps, or outside of the estate.
Mm-hmm.
So that way, the child who is, you know, they're the next in line to take the throne of this deli, they're going to get the deli and the value that is associated with it, but maybe they're not getting the house because the house is going to the other sibling.
Harry, David, we do have a caller. We have George from Colony.
Hey, George.
Morning, George.
Good morning. Good morning, Harry. I'm a client of yours. I have a quick question. My trust has been over 6 or 7 years now. My sister's house was recently put into a trust. She is going to go into memory care, and her assets will probably last her 4 years in the memory care. Myself and my kids have been discussing using money from my trust to help fund her last year if they have to, only because the family would like to keep her home in, you know, we would like to keep the home without having to sell it if we can. And I don't know if that's good idea.
Well, in other words, her house is in her trust, right?
Yeah, we just started.
Yeah, no, I understand that, yeah. But you don't want to sell her house, is that correct? I mean, if she ran out of money.
I would not like to sell. I would actually, at some point, would move into her house, and my kids would like to keep it for a while if they can.
Okay, yeah, okay. So we don't want to do that. I mean, if she has no other assets, then if she's in an assisted living facility in memory care, as opposed to a nursing home,
right,
then, yeah, you'd have to cover the difference other than whatever her income would provide
out of other family assets.
Yeah,
they can't touch the principal of the trust, but they can actually draw some money out to help pay some of the bill.
I'm sorry, George. You mean from your trust?
Yes, from my trust.
Yeah, from George's trust.
Principal could be removed from your trust. It's kind of like, you know, moving the fridge, like we were talking about earlier this hour. So through something called a partial revocation, you could take principal out of your trust if you wanted to use it to help your sister. One of the things I would tell you is if she herself has enough money to private pay assisted living for a number of years, I would not do anything from your trust until down the road when you need to do something, because a couple of things may happen. Number one, you may remove money from the trust and God forbid she passes away. So now you're unprotected money. Number two, she may need a nursing home in short order. It's not a big stretch to say if someone's in memory care, sometime in the next 5 years they may need a nursing home.
Right.
And the timing as to if and when she needs a nursing home would give you one other option, which is you buy the house. So your trust can buy the house, you can buy the house. And now your sister would have money, or trust would have money instead of a house. And if she did need a nursing home, depending on the amount of money, and how far along we are in her look-back period when that event happens, Mike or Jessica, our paralegals here, would implement a loan and gift plan to save half of the money you just paid her for her house. So I think you have all options on the table, because the trust gives you that flexibility, as well as your sister's trust gives her flexibility through her trustee or through her power of attorney to sell the house. You have the ability in your trust to remove money if that's what you decided to do.
Okay, so probably the best thing for me to do, like, wait for maybe three. She's good for at least 3 years, but see how things go in 3 years, and then check in with you. We can go.
As long as she's got enough money to pay, yes. Mm-hmm. But I would, you know, keep us in the loop, you know. In two or 3 years, let's, you know, at least talk on the phone and see how everything's going. You know, the cost of these facilities keeps going up and up, as you know. Yep. And, you know, it could be you're chewing up cash faster than you thought you would. And maybe instead of having 4 years, you only have 3 years. So keep us in the loop so we don't get down to the end of the road and then get in a time crunch where we're going to do. I think what David's saying is there are a couple of different options here that might work. We don't need to do anything immediately, but down the road, we want to look at what the best option is. So we don't, we've got enough time to plan. That's what we're talking about with businesses, you know. Planning. And so, you know, that's the sum and substance of what we're telling you.
Sounds good. Enjoy the Precipio, Harry.
Thanks, George.
All right.
You too.
Bye.
We do have another caller. We have Larry in Slingerlands.
Hello. Morning.
Hi. Harry, you set up an irrevocable trust about 10 years ago for us. And the trust has to pay New York State and federal taxes. If we decided to move to Florida, the beneficiaries are still in different states. Can that trust be domiciled in Florida so it doesn't have to pay New York State tax?
Well, first of all, the trust doesn't pay taxes. You should be paying the taxes on the trust income. Now, the trust files a return, but it doesn't actually pay taxes.
Yeah, I've been paying the taxes on the trust. Yeah, you're right. I have.
Right. No, you would still continue to do that. Yeah, if you, I mean, yeah, the situs of your trust could be, the situs is the, it's like the domicile, is where the trust lives, all right? Your trust lives in New York, okay?
Mm-hmm.
We could change the domicile, because once you leave New York, if the income is from dividends and interest, then you probably would file a fiduciary tax return in that state. The reason I might not want to change the location of the trust is because you were listening earlier, and David and I were talking about the toaster and the refrigerator analogy.
Yeah, it was.
Not all states. We talk about this partial revocation of the trust.
Uh-huh.
New York, not all states allow a partial revocation of a trust. Like New York says, under certain circumstances, the person who set up a trust, even though it's irrevocable, with the consent of all the people who have a beneficial interest in the trust, you can revoke an irrevocable trust and actually take money out of it and put it back in your name. Not all states allow that, okay? I just recently had a situation with a client who lived in New York and moved to California. And he had a trust, and we were talking about, I said, don't move the situs to California, because his lawyer in California said, you can't revoke an irrevocable trust in California without court approval, and you're probably not going to get it. So these are the things we want to look at in making these decisions. But from a tax standpoint, whatever state you live in, if you know, you're still going to, your trust is not a taxable entity, whether you live in New York or you live in, you know, Florida. So if you moved to Florida, which has no state income tax, you'd file a federal return, pay the federal tax on it. But I don't think you'd have to continue paying New York tax on if you're completely domiciled in Florida and have no further connections to New York.
How about if the trust owns income-producing property in New York? Oh, I still have to pay New York tax, yeah.
Yeah, if you have rental income from New York, you know, again, I'm not a tax expert. You got to double check everything I say, please, with your accountant. But your rental income would probably be subject to New York State taxes, I think, because that's where the property is. Okay.
The thing I always say to clients is your trust didn't make your taxes better, and they didn't make them worse. So it kind of is what it is. So whatever the rules would be, as, if you as an individual lived in Florida, primary residence, but had income-producing property in New York, if there was no trust, those tax rules should apply with the trust as well.
Okay, and one last question. The trustee of the trust, that can be changed by the beneficiaries? Or who would change the trustee?
No, no. We're talking about a Medicaid, an asset protection trust, right? Is that what we have here?
Yes. Yes.
Okay. If I did that trust 10 years ago, yes, somewhere in your trust toward the end in paragraph probably 11, 12, there's a provision that allows you to change the trustee to someone else as long as it's not you or your spouse, okay? Now, okay. Your beneficiaries can't, you can change a trustee, but the beneficiaries can't change a trustee, no.
Okay. All right, so do I? So if I want to do that, I would come in and you'd make that revision for us?
Yeah. If you wanted to change a trustee, you might not even have to come in. We could call me up on the phone and we can talk about it. Even here in North Carolina, I can get your file right up. I'm sitting here looking at my laptop. I can get your file up on the computer. You can talk on the phone, and you don't have to wait till I come back from North Carolina. You know, I'm fully operational down here.
You know, we also have other attorneys at the firm in case you need something. We could spit it out really, really quickly for you, Larry. So whatever you need, talk to Harry, and then Harry could let our staff know, and then we could from here get it to you. If you're in New York, you can come in. If you're in Florida, we'll FedEx it down to you, whatever you need.
Perfect. Thank you. You've been very helpful, and I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening. Take care. Have a good weekend.
Bye-bye.
All right, we're coming up almost to 8:30, so we're going to take our break right here. We'll be right back with the second half of the Herzog Law Firm's Estate Medicaid Planning Hour coming up right after this.
You've been listening to the Estate and Medicaid Planning Hour with the Herzog Law Firm. Join us every week to learn more about protecting the assets you've worked hard for, options available for Medicaid planning, and more. With offices located in Corporate Woods in Albany, West Harrison Street in Saratoga Springs, Executive Woods in Clifton Park, and 130 North Front Street in Kingston, our attorneys are here to help you. If you'd like to schedule an appointment to speak with David, Jane Marie, or Harry, please call us during normal business hours Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. To contact us at our Albany office, call 518-465-7581. Our Saratoga Springs office, 518-581-8131. Our Clifton Park office at 518-952-4010. And our Kingston office at 845-338-6405. Let the Herzog Law Firm help navigate a plan that works for you and your family. Now back to the Estate and Medicaid Planning Hour with the Herzog Law Firm.
And hey, welcome back, everybody. This is the Herzog Law Firm's Estate Medicaid Planning Hour, and I'm Harry Miller.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Dave Kabikian. Harry and I were talking in the first half hour about a number of different topics. We got a couple callers as well, George and Larry. Thanks, guys. You can be our next caller by calling 518-476-5900 if you got something you want to talk about, and maybe it's a little private or you don't want to share it with all of our listeners. You can call our office at 518-465-7581. You know, Harry, I mentioned I'm in the office today, and I'm actually seeing some clients today.
Stacey, I heard that, yeah.
So if you're itching to get into Stacy, 518-465-7581. She's not going to be happy I'm saying this out loud because she was planning on doing a lot of work and not answering calls. However, if you need her, give her a call. Okay?
Definitely.
Before the call, Harry. I'm sorry, go ahead, Harry.
Well, before the calls, we were talking about this example that you have in your business, the Saratoga Business Review article. Really funny when I was reading it this week, everything sent it to me. I have recently dealt with exactly the fact pattern that you put in your article. I had a client owned a business. He had three children, one of whom was actively involved and actually running the business for several years before the father passed away. All right, and then there was another child who was involved in the business, but not to the same extent that the first child was in terms of running everything. And then there was a third child who was not involved in the business at all, and although she lived in the area, did something completely different, unrelated to. And so it's the same thing. We want to treat the kids equally, but we don't want to. When dad passes away, we want the number one child to have control of the business. And I said, what do we do here? And it was a business that has a fairly significant amount of value. So here we had maybe this was an easy fix in a way, because what we did over time was, first of all, before all these things happened, we basically transferred some of the ownership, and the ownership was in a trust, and so we transferred ownership to the two children that were involved in the business, but not equally. All right, and fair is not always equal, as you know. So the son who ran the business was getting a controlling interest, not just interest, a controlling interest. Okay, so. And the other child was getting an interest. And then there was a third person who was a key employee, not related to dad, who was also getting an ownership interest because, you know, an equity interest, because he's very critical to the operation of the business. So the other children who weren't getting a lesser interest, we allocated other assets of the estate to those children. And I don't think it worked out exactly dollar for dollar. So, again, it wasn't precisely equal. But it wasn't like we were excluding the unrelated child. The father had a significant amount of life insurance, for instance. So we had the life insurance go to the child who was not involved in the business to compensate her to some extent for the offsetting value of the business that was going to the other two children. So these are the kinds of planning that you have to do over time. And, you know, that's just one example.
Well, Harry, you brought up another example of this, because you mentioned the word insurance. So one of the other types of situations we see is it's not a family business. You started a business with a friend of yours, right? Harry and I started that widget company, and it's grown. And our operating documents say we are, you know, we each have shares in this company, and because it's a good, you know, operating agreement or underlying documents, it'll say if a shareholder dies, his or her shares go as follows. And you know, again, we want the as follows part to match your plan, whatever your plan may be. But if it says it goes to my wife, Isabel, right? So if I died, Isabel gets my portion. And in fact, the agreements are so good, it says my portion is worth $1 million, Harry, right? Mm-hmm. If I died, you're gonna look around and say, oh, well, I got machines, I make widgets, I got employees. What I don't have is $1 million cash to give to Dave's wife because right. He died. So how exactly would this work? Does my business go under? Because literally I need to close the business to be able to abide by the terms. Well, what a lot of businesses do, and this is through financial advisors, insurance brokers, and so on, is they'll get what's called a key man life insurance policy, which the business gets, and the business has that policy. How much is that policy for? Well, I don't know, say $1 million. And so upon the death of me, because I'm the insured party, I'm the life that is being insured, rather. If I died, the business immediately gets $1 million, which Harry conveniently then gives to my wife because that was what our document said. Again, none of this just happens. A lot of people, Harry, we see it. They created an LLC a long time ago. They got a little partnership. They never even thought about doing the operating agreement part of the partnership because New York State didn't require it. They've been in business. They're doing well. They're filing partnership tax returns. They're getting a K-1 at the end of the year. All is well. But if somebody passes, all heck is going to break loose because all that value that the business had is nowhere to be found. It's not liquid.
Well, and there's no agreement as to how it's going to be retired. You know, we have more and more people who have been in business together say, oh, well, what happens? What's going to happen? Oh, well, you know, I guess he would buy me out or she would buy me out. And I say, well, but there's nothing in writing. Okay, there's nothing in writing about that. And there's no insurance or there's inadequate amount of insurance to affect the buyout. And the other thing is sometimes people just retire instead of dying. And so if they're leaving a business and they want to be bought out by the people who are remaining and running the business, you need an agreement. You know, when we formed corporations, they were called shareholders agreements, or redemption agreements with the company. The company would buy back your shares or the other shareholders. It would be a cross-purchase agreement. Now, virtually all businesses are set up in what are called limited liability companies because they have tremendous advantages. They have the advantage of being tax-like partnerships, which is very good, and there's one layer of taxation, and yet they have insulation from liability like corporations do. And then we had this beast called a subchapter S corporation, which is, you know, a corporation that gets taxed similar to a partnership. But there's so many complicated rules with S corporations, and particularly putting them in trust. There's all kinds of weird rules about who can be an S corporation shareholder that they're, you know, it's very complicated. LLCs are simple. They're easy to understand. And so you have an agreement in an LLC, the people who own it are called members instead of stockholders. But basically, it's the same thing, right? So you got to have an agreement about what's going to happen if I die, if I retire, if I become disabled, if you just fire me, you know, you want to get rid of me. You know, something has to happen depending on what the circumstances are, and we have to develop a plan to be bought out that, as David has said, doesn't crush the company. You don't want to kill the goose that laid the golden egg, right?
Absolutely. Harry, one of the other things I emailed you about was a friend of mine, a client who we're going to be doing a little bit of work for, but he did a good amount of work on his own. He's a restaurant owner, and he owns the building that the restaurant is in. And, you know, rather than everything in one pile under one umbrella, the one entity actually owns the real estate. One entity owns the business. If he stopped the business, he still owns the real estate and can rent it out to somebody else. If there was an issue with one entity, it wouldn't affect the other entity the way he did it. And he mentioned to me that, you know, they have a little camp and they were thinking this year of starting to Airbnb it. They're not as concerned about COVID anymore. A couple of years have gone by. So now they think they can make some side money with the Airbnb, and it's not their primary residence. So I said, hey, you know, listen, you got one entity, that's the business. You got one entity, that is the building that the business is in. You got your own house, and then you got this camp. You know, life is good, but let's not, you know, ruin things because there's some awful event when someone is using the Airbnb. Let's get that camp perhaps in its own LLC, again, to try to limit the liability associated with things. So, you know, we don't want too many things in a single entity because then it kind of defeats the purpose. You know, we have lots of clients who have a lot of rental properties in the Albany area or up in Saratoga or a little further south in Kingston. And when they have multiple rental properties, I got an LLC. Well, how many properties are in that LLC? Well, now I have four in there. Well, if something happens in one of those
properties, that's a bad idea.
It started good with one, maybe two. Right, but and the idea is to, you know, get my personal assets away from these other assets that I own, these rental properties. But it's constant, not only planning, but then constant tweaking of the plan because life changes and property values go up or you know, this and that. But you all got to have a plan. And then the last piece of it, Harry, is that plan needs to match your good old-fashioned will or that Medicaid trust or revocable trust or whatever your estate planning document is. And, you know, I'm expecting some calls here. We have 20 minutes left, 518-476-5900. So instead of waiting on this, I'm just going to give this pattern out loud, Harry. So I had a client come in. I think they'll be a client. It was a consultation. And they have some good money, Harry. And they showed me their wills. And they have good old-fashioned wills, good language about the ability for each spouse to do what's called a disclaimer when it comes to money that they're supposed to inherit. Right. And this is a maneuver to try to save on estate taxes. We're not going to tell you the history of estate taxes or anything. But they have a will that's got all the right beats to save every dollar when it comes to estate taxes.
Right.
That's all you need to know.
Everything's in there. Yeah.
There's one problem. I looked at their assets. I looked at what they own. I looked at how they own it. I asked them, who's your beneficiary on this? Who's your beneficiary on that? They gave me all the information. And I said to them, listen, you guys have a wonderful will. In fact, you have two. You each have a will. It's great. But if one of you, God forbid, dies, none of your money, none of your dollars are going to go through your will. None of your dollars will be subject to those rules. You know why? Because you have your wife as beneficiary on everything. You have your husband as beneficiary on everything. So it's got to be a really well-thought-out plan. So for them, I said, well, if I were you, I would do one of two things. I'd either take each other off as beneficiaries, so we have very large probates where your will language will now govern, and we have all that good language about estate taxes, or you have a lot of money. Let's do two revocable trusts. We talked about this, I think, the last time we were on the radio together, Harry. Revocable trusts with the same language. And then, not done yet, you make sure these other assets you own either get into that trust when you die or they're already in your trust while you're alive. We need your assets to be governed by the rules that you set up. So, you know, you could get in a lot of trouble. I just paid a lot of money for this will. It's got all the beats. Fantastic.
Yeah, but they were not properly advised. I mean, whoever did the estate plan, the estate plan isn't just preparing the documents, the will, the trust, whatever it happens to be. You have to look at the assets as part of our counseling to the client. Make sure the assets are going to get where they're supposed to go. And if you can't leave everything in joint names, as you say, if you have everything then goes on death to the surviving spouse, guess what happens? I mean, the surviving spouse could still do a disclaimer, all right? But guess where the assets are going to go? To the kids then, probably, instead of into the trust. So you've defeated the whole purpose of the estate plan because you didn't really do the job that you're talking about you're doing for these people now. So, you know, I mean, we see this frequently. We don't just push paper out of a printer and then have you sign it. We got to look at every single estate plan is unique to that particular client. And particularly when we have significant assets, we're talking about things, we're dealing with estate taxes. We're talking about people who have some fairly significant estate tax exposure possibly down the road. And that could come into play at some time. So, you know, you're doing exactly the right thing.
Harry, forget all the money. Forget having, lots of assets. Forget having a business. If you have a two-year-old that's at home right now, and you have life insurance, and you have a will that says, I give everything to my wife, then I give everything to my kids in trust. And you have all these good ages, 22, 25, 30, a little bit here, a little bit there. Pay for college, do this, do that. That's great. Let me ask you a question. Who's your backup beneficiary on your life insurance? I know your wife is number one. Who will be number two?
Mm-hmm.
And there are so many people who walk amongst us, and thank God that date night hasn't gone wrong for them and their spouse, because if, God forbid, it did, the rules in their will won't be in charge of the money because they have their kids as backups. And it's you know, what we, the part that we do where we're producing documents, that's just a part of your estate plan. The assets you own that go somewhere when you die is the other part. And we got to link them. Sometimes they're retirement. Sometimes they're these business interests. Mm-hmm. You know, whatever it is, it's this, you know. Harry, there are other, sorry about the infomercial about Herzog here, everybody, but there's other firms that do half-hour consultations. I don't know how I can learn about someone entirely in half an hour. Maybe I'm just not good at it. But I need the full hour because there's a lot to talk about. And it's not just, hey, you need a will. There's all these other things out there.
Mm-hmm. You absolutely do. Yeah. You know, the backup beneficiary of my life insurance is my trust. So that, you know, if my wife, is the primary beneficiary, my trust, and because that way, my trust will get it where it's supposed to go, okay? As opposed to having somebody else there, you know? And that's,
Harry, did you spell Ben Patton correctly on your trust, by the way?
Well, I didn't have his address and his Social Security number because you have to put that on the beneficiary form. So.
That's all right. I'll give it to you right now.
Yeah, give it to us right now.
555-555-5555. Okay. Who cares where the address is? Just send it here in Latham.
I have the address there. I know where it is.
Thank you.
All right.
Harry, last week, Jay Marie and I were on, and we were talking about what to do when your client, number one, asks you to be the trustee or the executor or even the power of attorney. But what do you do? What do you recommend to them when they say, listen, you know, I just lost my husband. I don't talk to my kid, or I don't have anyone. I don't know who's going to be my agent. I don't know what to take here. Mm-hmm. How do you advise people? Because I usually say, I mean, is there a friend? Is there a sibling? I don't care if they're older than you. I need someone for in case you something bad happens tomorrow. How do you advise people?
It's tough for people that don't have anyone because they do invariably ask us to do that. We have always in the firm declined acting as our client's fiduciary, executor, or trustee, unless there happen to be family members or unusually special circumstances. You know, over the course of my career, I think I've done it once or twice. I normally have regretted doing it, and so I don't generally do it. We look at other advisors sometimes if there's someone who is in a close personal friend. Sometimes people have, you know, brothers, sisters, nephews, cousins. I'm going through one right now where there's an issue with a client, with both of the client's children. They're both adults. One of them, I think, may have a disability. The other one doesn't, but probably wouldn't be a good manager of those things. So the client has a brother who lives out of town, and then he has a son-in-law who lives somewhere else, and so those people are gonna step in and act. It's tough because you know most of the time, I don't know if you, but these days it is very difficult to get institutions like banks to act as trustees unless there's a tremendous amount of money in place. And frankly, an institutional trustee is usually never my first choice anyway, except in very limited circumstances because they have their own issues and baggage that come with them. So it's a tough situation. When we don't have any, you know, we have occasionally is that what you generally do?
Yes. The power of attorney is a kind of a different story to me than the executor because the executor has nothing to do with you until, you know, you're no longer here. And at that point, they're by definition, they kind of have their job written out for them. They collect assets, they... Mm-hmm. pay bills, and then they divide everything based on your will. There's no discretion they typically need to use. Trustees, you know, if you're doing a Medicaid trust, if you're doing a revocable trust, Medicaid trust, there's not a lot for your trustee to do, right? They sign a couple things at the beginning. They sign some stuff after you pass, or if you're incapacitated, maybe they take on a role. You know, you decide to sell your house. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the trustee's involved. It's not as a active role as mm-hmm. people probably think. The power of attorney, though, that you know, I've thought about being trustee before. I would never ever be a power of attorney for someone because mm-hmm. you know, you don't want me holding your checkbook, and I don't want to do that. And really, there's so much that can go wrong there, and it's unfortunate when people don't have, you know, nothing says it's got to be family, by the way. It could be a friend, it could be a neighbor, it could be a just in case because you are okay. And oh, by the way, if you didn't do the power of attorney, Harry, what's going to happen? We're going to do a guardianship proceeding. It's going to cost $15,000 between all the different attorneys involved in that process. And the court's going to name someone for you. So, you know, might as well pick someone yourself rather than having the court name someone for you.
Yeah, I think it's a tough decision for people to come to. And very often, frankly, the non-family member very often is the better choice in a lot of situations. Because they will, you know, they don't have anything. They're not conflicted in the same way that family members might be. So yeah. Good.
Harry, I do have one more fact pattern for you, if you don't mind. And this is hot off the presses from 3 o'clock yesterday and is going to continue on Monday at 4:30 when I meet the family at Evergreen Nursing and Rehab. So, yeah, unfortunately, Dad passed away, and leaving a spouse and two grown children. Spouse, who was the beneficiary on Dad's life insurance, about $25,000 of life insurance. She has MS and has dementia and is overall, if that's not enough, it's just overall not doing well. That's why she's at Evergreen. And there's a very good probability, if not a certainty, that she will never go home again. Okay? So not good stuff. And based on the facts and the other assets, I look around and say, okay, well, good news is it looks like your mom should qualify for Medicaid based on the assets and this and that. There was a house, but one of the boys has been living in the house with mom, so there's a child caretaker exemption. We can move that house to him, et cetera, et cetera. So Dad didn't have a will, and where he did have something with beneficiaries, he named his wife. So he knows how his wife was doing. In fact, he, for the last 30 years, has been a caretaker for her because of the MS piece of the issue. The
problem. This has been around for a while.
And knowing that, he did not do a will to make sure everything goes to his children instead of his wife. And knowing that, he didn't change his life insurance policy. And, you know, we send these letters out to our clients. Say, you know, it's been 5 years since you've been here. Why don't you come and let's talk? There's no fee for it, right? We just, what's changed? Has anything changed? Nothing changed. Great. Maybe people moved. Maybe we need to update addresses or just phone numbers or just say hi. But we get so, you know, involved in what's around us and dealing with the care. I'm sure he was thinking of a gazillion things because he was such a good caregiver for his wife. However, facts change over time, and it's so incredibly important that we have the ability to tweak the plan. It might be just changing the life insurance beneficiary. We have nothing to do with that, right? But it would just be that recommendation to him, so that way we wouldn't have to figure out, is she going to qualify? Is there going to be a 1 month I got a private pay? Did I just lose $15,000 in the equation, et cetera, et cetera? And every time we have a fact pattern like that, and unfortunately really often, you know, just a little bit of just update can make a world of difference because, you know, no one anticipated he was going to pass, right? He was the caregiver. Right. How's the caregiver going to pass away first? So of course it happened.
It does. It does. And, you know, the review, the review is so important. I know we send out lots and lots of letters that say, you know, you haven't been here in 5 years. You know, you really at least call us on the phone. Let's go over the paperwork and look at that. I don't know what the probably more than half of them just don't respond to it. It's and then we wind up with these unfortunate situations where a very simple thing could have been done by putting the children on as the beneficiaries instead of the spouse that has MS. The family could have saved all that money, and now, you know,
in this case, it's just a reminder that, man, dodge the bullet, because what happens if your son wasn't living with mom? Now we have this house that's going to be a resource for purposes of Medicaid. We're going to have a lien.
That's a resource.
We're going to...
What if it was $100,000 life insurance policy instead of $25,000? You know, it's all about numbers and it's all about planning, and we can't stress how important that is, as you have said and we've said. You know, estate planning it's not a once and done thing. It's an evolving process that follows you really throughout the course of your life. And as we all know very well, the nature, extent, and the events in our life change and grow and age and sometimes change quite dramatically through circumstances that are not in our control. And those are the things where we have to gut back, readjust, sometimes reinvent ourselves, and come up with a different plan, move in a different direction. And it's just, you know, it's part of being a person.
Yeah, exactly right. And the thing is, Harry, everyone has a plan. Right? Even no plan is a plan, because the laws in New York say what's going to happen to
no
money.
Plan. You have made a plan. And if you have made a plan, the state of New York has made one for you. Right?
And it's not like that plan is an awful plan. It's not like New York State's leaving everything to Ben. That would be weird.
That'd be great.
No, that would be very odd, Ben. you would be a suspect in every death. Don't tell you.
Okay. All right.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, we've had mom inherits money sometimes, and mom's in the nursing home, or, you know, a disabled child inherits a lot of money, and now they're not getting the benefits that they were going to get, or we got to scramble to try to keep their benefits. Because the New York statutes that talk about who gets what, if you don't have a will, doesn't say, but if your kid is two, well, we'll hold it in trust until they're 30. It just says, okay, well, just get it all at 18, and that's that. So, you know, no plan is a plan, but it doesn't mean it's a good plan.
And then your two-year-old owns an interest in some real property, right? And that's going to restrict anything you can do with that property when a beneficial interest is owned by a minor. You need court approval to do anything, to lease it, mortgage it, sell it, anything.
How about, I passed and we didn't have our ducks in a row here in your... Your widget company co-owners include Alex and Jacqueline. How do you like that?
Well, I mean, it's just a disaster waiting to happen. It is, and it's some improper planning, or no planning, not improper planning, because you would never do that. But if you want to preserve the equity ownership interest, because and I have this situation right now, the husband with the house, which we'll talk about next week. Okay. Anyway, sounds like we're out of time. So everybody have a great weekend. Stay warm, and we'll talk to you next week.
Harry, go put on the AC down there, all right? Take care.
Bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to the Estate and Medicaid Planning Hour with the Herzog Law Firm. For more information on their services, please visit herzoglaw.com. If you'd like to speak with one of their attorneys, please contact the Albany office at 518-465-7581, the Saratoga office at 518-581-8131, or their Kingston office at 845-338-6405.